good news and issues from a superior point of view.
It's a 2.5 mile trip on Lake Superior 20 times a day and never gets boring.
Sometimes it absolutely feels like a vacation, but without the ferry, there'd be no Madeline Island.
We check in with the Madeline Island Ferry. But first, he was one of the Twin Ports' most accomplished musicians who never forgot his roots.
He always came back. He always kept in contact.
That was pretty neat to see him always come back. And like, he's working with Whitney Houston.
We remember Michael Baker. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. When Michael Baker was barely a preteen, he tapped real and imaginary drumsticks against anything that would make a sound. He continued to do so in band class at Duluth Central High School in the 1970s, where band director Jim Stellmacher took him under his wing. Stellmacher also brought to the school big band legend Clark Terry, who met up with Baker a few years later and also took him under his wing, and the rest is history. Michael went on to join the band and many others, playing with A-listers from Michael Jackson to Sting to Elton John. Most notably, he was Whitney Houston's music director for nearly 20 years until her 2012 death. Sadly, Michael, who spent his time in Italy and the Twin Cities in recent years, is being mourned himself in his home community after succumbing to cancer last weekend. With us are two of the many friends and admirers from the Twin Ports, Kim Stellmacher Anderson and Mike Stellmacher, whose father was the drummer's mentor. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Mike and Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mike, you were a couple of years behind Michael, who graduated in 1975, but you knew him back then and you knew a story about him from junior high.
Yes, actually, there's probably a couple from junior high, but the very first introduction I had to Michael Baker was he was in junior high. I suppose he was ninth grade. I was seventh grade. And we used to have talent shows back then. And we would kind of do traveling shows where they would, one junior high would go to the other. And Michael's from Washington, junior. I was at Ordine. And he came to Ordine and did a drum solo as part of the talent show. And the whole audience was just mesmerized. Like, are you kidding me? Who is this? So that was my first introduction to Michael Baker. And I went backstage afterwards and just said, oh, my God. I mean, wow, I've never heard anything like this. So it left a very big impression upon me then. And then he wasn't allowed to be in the junior high band. My father caught wind of that, and he searched down Michael when it came time to register for classes at Central and said, hey, I want you in the band, because he knew Michael wanted to be in music. And so he said, and Michael says, well, I don't know how to read music. And my dad just said, I'm going to teach you. And that was kind of the beginning of a really, really good relationship.
And it went on from there, the Clark Terry story?
Yep. So Dad used to have guest artists come to Central and perform with the bands, you know, the concert bands, jazz bands, and all that. And one year he had Clark Terry, and that just happened to be when Mike was the drummer at Central. So we did that and all that. And of course, Mike did great. Clark Terry was fantastic. Well, years later, it wasn't too many years, maybe 3 years, I guess, Mike had transferred from, he was at UMD, and then he transferred down to North Texas State University. At that time, basically the number one jazz school in the country. And Clark Terry came by, and he recognized and remembered Mike from Duluth Central. And that's where he invited Mike to be part of his band. And Michael said, yeah, of course. So that started Michael's real professional career with a lot of big names.
Kim, did you know him in those years? I don't know if you're the older sister, younger sister, or...
I graduated a decade and a half later. However, I was always at Central, around the band room. I grew up in the band room, and I certainly knew who Michael Baker was. When you're young and you've got those older kids that you look up to, and I'm like, oh, this guy's awesome.
Well, he wasn't a stranger by any means, because he always came back.
Yeah, absolutely. And that for sure, I remember Michael would come back, and even into his Whitney Houston days, whenever he was remotely in town, even into the cities, he would come up, contact my parents, and he always came back to Dad. It was like, that was a big, big thing for him to always kind of say thanks and hey, I appreciate what you did for me. And so that was pretty neat to see him always come back. And, you know, it's like, he's working with Whitney Houston. He's working with all of these amazing jazz artists.
Well, pop artists and everybody. Yeah, right.
Right, right. Exactly. But he was still just so humble and so grateful and everything. And it was neat to see the relationship between him and Dad when they would come and have dinner.
Mm-hmm. Well, no better example was in 2011, where in a tribute to your father, where Michael flew in from Tuscany just to be here, both at Duluth Central High School at the time, and then at the Shack in Superior. And at the concert at Central, he was part of a reunion band, again, a concert in tribute to your dad. Here's a selection from that, which Michael finishes with a drum solo. And that was Michael Baker playing in the 2011 tribute to Duluth Central High School band director Jim Stellmacher. We're speaking with Kim Stellmacher Anderson and Mike Stellmacher, and we're remembering Michael Baker, who passed away last weekend. Mike, you have another story from high school?
Yeah, I was in the band room. I think it was the very first day of school. And I'm hearing back in the practice room somebody just rip-roaring up and down the keyboard, piano, just doing scales after scales, up and down. And I asked my father, I said, "Who's that piano player back there? Holy cow." And that's where Dad goes, "Well, yeah, that's our drummer." So Michael, I mean, he had tremendous talent, but I'll tell you what, he worked like, I mean, he was focused and he worked like nobody I've ever seen. So one reason that he, well, besides his talent was, so he was out in LA and he did a lot of studio gigs. And one reason he got so many gigs was because, you know, when you're in studio work, time is money. And they knew that he would show up straight. So, well, yeah, I mean,
it's a joke, but it's not. Yeah, right. It's a reality.
Well, no, I mean, they knew that they'd get 100% performance from him.
Right. Kim, I want to go back to his, you know, just how down to earth he was.
Yeah, absolutely. And the time that I spent the most time with him actually was when he came back for my dad's tribute concert in 2011. Mm-hmm. When he was asked, it was like a no-brainer. He instantly said, "Yep, I'll come back." And it's not just like a minute away. He was in Italy at the time. So to have him come back was great. And we there were three bands that played that particular concert. And he basically played a feature or just kind of played at least one song with each band. He played with the Central Jazz Band, and he was so great with the kids and never any ego and could not have been more gracious. Mm-hmm. And then he also played with the North Shore Big Band and also with Big Time Jazz Orchestra. And he, again, was very gracious and fit into each one of those bands. And actually, one of the biggest compliments I got, because I was running the rehearsals for the North Shore Big Band, was afterwards he came up and kind of just gave me a big smile. And I go, "What?" And he said, "You look so much like your dad up there." And I was like, "Oh, that was the best compliment," because I knew how much he loved Dad and respected him. And it was just, it was a great compliment to get. And like I said, I couldn't say anything better about him. Just a really great guy.
Mm-hmm. Another thing is when he came back to Central at the tribute concert, he did clinics at Central. He did clinics really everywhere over at UWS and that. And he was just so good with the kids. But one thing that always stuck out was one of the questions in the audience was about the sounds, the type of music that had evolved, you know, a lot of electronic music. And, you know, Michael was a producer as well. So somebody asked him about that is like almost insinuating it was kind of the downfall of music. And his response was, "You have to continue to evolve." He said he was fascinated with the sounds the kids grew up with that became music. He was amazed at it, and it helped him grow as a musician and evolve. So to me, it's just fascinating how he took that and was always moving forward in music. So
yeah, I completely agree. And I think Michael was a really good example of hard work, tenacity. And he also had the skill set to be a musical director. You know, that takes a whole different set of talent to do that. So that's what kind of made me go, "Oh, he's not just a drummer. He's all of this stuff," which is fascinating.
And even that is an understatement. We've been speaking with Kim Stellmacher Anderson and Mike Stellmacher. We're remembering Michael Baker, who passed away last weekend. Thank you for joining us, Kim and Mike.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
As you just heard, Michael Baker's musical talents covered a wide range of genres, and his work with Whitney Houston and other top stars was celebrated around the world. And who better to explain it than Michael himself? Here he is in a 2018 interview speaking with pianist and big band leader Peter Jacques of the Jazzar Festival in Switzerland.
Michael Baker,
yes.
A long time you spent, yes, being musical director of one of the biggest pop stars.
Yes, yes.
There's nothing like Whitney Houston.
Yeah, that's right.
She must have liked you very much to stay such a long time under your wings.
You know, that's a very interesting point, because I never thought about it very much, because really, after every tour, I thought I was fired. After every time we finished touring, I would go home and I would think, oh, they're never going to call me again.
What gave you the idea?
Because I never thought I did a very good job for her. I didn't think that I knew what kind of artist she was. I knew how great she was, and so I never thought I came up to the same level.
But you played with Freddie Hubbard and the Ellington Orchestra, amongst others.
Yeah.
When did that switch to pop come?
After I had my daughter, my first child, and I wasn't making enough money. And I was actually working with Joe Zawinul, and I was at the Blue Note. We were just finishing one of our last nights at the Blue Note, and Joe asked me, he says, what are you going to do next?
Right.
And I said, well, Joe, I said, I'm going to go start doing R&B music, because I need to make more money for my family. So it was because of that, really.
I see. When you started with Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
Did it change also in terms of the jobs you got besides her?
Everything opened up a lot more in terms of pop music and commercial music. So I found myself, I was also working with like Al Jarreau, and I did a couple of things with, at one point I found myself working, you know, on same stage with Sting and Elton John and James Taylor at, you know, in Carnegie Hall at the Rainforest Foundation.
Right.
I started working with Bruce Hornsby, pop, more commercial things started to open up.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because of that job.
Did you ever do anything that you afterwards thought, oh, I better wouldn't have done that?
There is one thing that, I mean, maybe not in terms of work, but I think that there was a time where there's a couple of mistakes that I made that I wish that I hadn't have made.
But not musical.
No, not musically. Not musically, but I made some character decisions that maybe I would have not liked to have had happen with me. But other than that, musically, I never wanted to play R&B music, and I never wanted to play that kind of music. I always wanted to. I'm basically a, you know, I'm a kid from Minnesota, you know, I used to play rock music. You know, I grew up playing rock and roll, I mean, hard rock, right, and rock bands. So I don't think I really liked R&B music that much. I liked rock, you know, I wanted to play with The Who or someone like that,
yeah,
you know,
right,
or Led Zeppelin, that kind of music. So, but most of the job decisions that I've made were because of my family and try to support my daughter and my kids, right, and my wife and stuff like that. So,
if your daughter started about being in show business as,
yeah,
a singer, for example,
yeah,
would you encourage her or try to talk her out of it?
I would talk her out of it.
I can understand that.
I'm really happy that none of my kids are in the music business. Because I feel as though they've already been in it.
Yeah, all right.
You know, because just, you know, me being their father, they've already been in the business of me not being home.
Home, yeah.
And they've already been in the business of wondering when Daddy was going to come back or how long I was going to stay or something. And, I mean, I like the fact that they are making their own decisions and it's not necessarily in the music business because they can already sing. They can play, you know, they already have it naturally. So, and the music industry has changed so dramatically that since it's changed so dramatically, it's not recognizable for what it
You're
used
right.
to be.
It's getting worse.
I kind of look at it like what you don't, you don't miss what you don't have.
Right.
And someone like me, I've been in the music business all my life. I might miss certain elements of that,
right.
but my kids, since they've never been involved in music like that or something, they don't miss it. And so,
I can understand that very, very well.
Yeah,
that's very nice.
Yeah.
I hope that you and your family will stay healthy.
Oh, thank you.
And the jobs will stay good.
Yeah, thank
and
you.
And thank you for having this talk.
No, thanks for having me. Appreciate it, really. I love to be here in Switzerland. It's one of my favorite places on
Lovely.
The planet. I love it here.
I hope you come back.
I hope to come back many more times. I really
thank
love
you.
It here. Thank you.
That was a 2018 conversation between Duluth's own Michael Baker and Peter Jacques of the Jazzar Festival in Switzerland. The Twin Ports and music world internationally are mourning the passing of Michael last week at his home in Italy after battling cancer. Coming up, the boat to Madeline Island from the captain's point of view. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Depending on the time of year, Madeline Island is home to about 430 people, or 2,500 during the summer tourist season. The largest of the Apostle Islands is 2.5 miles from Bayfield, which you can travel by driving the ice road when the lake is frozen over, and the rest of the time via the Madeline Island ferry. The 20-minute crossing can be absolutely beautiful most times, but when Lake Superior is being finicky, maybe a little scary. But it's never boring, not even for those who work the ferries, crossing it several times a day. Joining us is one of those, Captain Will Schaub of the Madeline Island Ferry. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Will.
Thank you for having me.
So, before we get into the actual ferry or your captaining, when was your first crossing?
My first crossing was before my first birthday. I don't live full time on the island, but I have spent my summers here my entire life. And so I don't remember my first crossing, but I remember, you know, from very, very young age going back and forth.
Mm-hmm. And when you're on the mainland, where do you live there?
I currently live outside Chicago, and I'm kind of a unique situation because I'm a school teacher the rest of the year, and I'm the ferry line's only seasonal captain. So I live in LaGrange, which is a suburb of Chicago, but then I live on the island from June through August.
And are you from Chicago?
Well, I grew up in Decatur, Illinois, which is central Illinois, and I lived on the East Coast, and I lived in California for 20 years. The one thing that's remained consistent in my life is my summers have always been spent on Madeline Island.
Well, when did you decide to become a mariner? And was it for somewhere else or always this job?
No, it was always this job. It's very specifically working for the ferries that's attracted me. I started originally working as a deckhand in 1987. I was just finished my freshman year of college, and it was one of my first summer jobs ever, and I loved it. I worked a couple summers as a deckhand, and then I finished college, and I went on with my life, and I had various careers, but I never forgot just the joy of being on the water, of you know, traveling back and forth, and it was just some of the fondest memories of my entire life. So much, much later, after a 30-year hiatus, I was a school teacher, and the idea germinated in me. I wonder if I could go back and work that into my life. So about 7 years ago, I came back to work for the ferries. I needed a few years as a deckhand, because to get a captain's license, you need a certain number of days of sea time. So it took me, working only in the summers, it took me a while to get to that threshold. But 3 years ago, I got my captain's license and started then learning how to drive the boats. And so that's what I've been doing. And that's my plan until I retire from teaching. And then I hope to continue driving the boats a more extended part of my year.
We're speaking with Will Shoup. He's a captain of the Madeline Island Ferry and joins us from the island. The ferry company has several boats. Do they each have names, and which is your favorite?
They do each have names. We have a fleet of five boats. Two of them, the Island Queen and the Nichevo, are predominantly wintertime boats because they're icebreakers. They're smaller, but they can go through up to maybe 10 inches of ice. So they're very useful, obviously, in the shoulder seasons before the lake is frozen over. But we also have the Madeline, we have the La Pointe, and we have the Bayfield. Those are our three big boats. And I do have a favorite. I drive predominantly the Madeline, and I like it because it's responsive. I can steer it well. It starts, it stops, it does what I want it to do. It's a little more susceptible to the wind than the other two big boats, so I have to admit that it has that feature, but that's the one I'm familiar with, and I consider it my boat when I'm here.
Well, that leads into, our obvious question, the weather. Well, what's the worst crossing? Lake Superior is Lake Superior. You look out there, boy, is it beautiful, and then 5 seconds later, out. So how about most challenging? Let's put it that way.
Well, yeah. Wind is the absolute primary factor in determining my day. I check the weather multiple times a day, but it's the first thing I do in the morning, and I'm specifically looking at wind. And as it turns out, today they forecast 15 to 20 mile an hour winds out of the southwest, which for me on my boat is not my favorite. it's given me crosswinds as I'm landing on the island. And like I said, my boat's a little susceptible to wind, so I'll be able to handle it, but that'll have me very focused every time I'm landing on the island today. So waves we can handle. If it's blowing hard northeast, of course, there's almost 400 miles of open lake out there. So if it's blowing northeast, we can get big rollers coming in, and that can be problematic, but that's pretty rare. And in those cases, when the conditions get too bad, we simply shut down. It's normally not for a period of a whole day even, but we'll shut down until the conditions improve, because obviously safety is paramount. For me, wind is everything, and I'm looking at the wind every single landing. I land a boat 20 times a day, and with every landing, I'm looking at that windsock. I'm looking at the flags on the sailboats. I'm looking at everything I can to know what the wind's doing and how it's going to, affect the boat.
20 times a day, is there, like a pilot, do you have limitations? How much and how many days per week do you do so?
We've gone, we used to work, kind of a traditional 5-day week. With the pandemic, we switched it up and went to 4-day work weeks, working longer shifts, and people like that. So that's what we're still doing. And I kind of like it. It gives me 3 days off in the summer, which is kind of great. But we do limit, and I don't think this is a Coast Guard regulation, but for the ferry line, we limit it to 12-hour shifts at the most. Because, listen, it's an important job. It's a lot of responsibility. We have up to 150 lives in our hands, and the company doesn't want us losing focus, getting tired, getting, distracted. So my shifts are typically 10 to 12 hours. So with a 10-hour shift, I'm typically landing every half an hour. So I say 20 landings a day, more or less that.
What's the most interesting cargo you've carried, or maybe most unusual vehicles? I saw a pretty big truck when I was out there.
I'm I'm sure there are things that are so big that we can't carry it, but I haven't seen it. So we've carried rock crushers that weighed I don't know how many tons. We certainly carry fully loaded semi-trailers, 53-foot trailers. I mean, you know, just absolutely anything. We can carry two coach buses end-to-end. We can carry multiple ready-mix trucks. Our biggest boat can handle almost 250,000 pounds in terms of payload. Earlier this summer, we brought over a house, half of it one day, the other half the next day. So it's funny because people will pull up and it's like, can you carry a 30-foot camper? It's like, buddy, I can carry four 30-foot campers at the same time. We can really handle just about anything.
How about the most interesting people or passengers?
Most interesting to me is the role we serve as part of the emergency services for the island. And that's the thing that most people coming across don't give a second thought to. What if I have a heart attack? What if I, you know, have a bee sting and I'm having an allergic reaction? What if I crash my motorcycle or moped or whatever? And we are on 24-hour call for that. We get calls at any time, either during the day or in the middle of the night, and we've got to hop to and get a boat ready to go if the ambulance needs to transport people. And on some busy summer days, we'll have 2, 3, 4 emergency calls a day, which is it's always exciting, you know. I don't mean that in a in a good way. It's a sense of urgency because I don't always know what the emergency is. Sometimes I have based on the alert, a general idea, but sometimes, you know, for privacy reasons, I don't have all the information. But we have to operate under the assumption that there's someone's life at stake. And so we've got to be there, ready to load up and get them over to the mainland as quickly as possible, because the nearest hospital from Bayfield is half an hour away. So if someone's had an emergency, they're almost certainly an hour away from emergency room. And it's, again, a responsibility we take incredibly seriously, doing our part to, you know, potentially save someone's life.
Sure. I think we would take this equally seriously. I understand there's no jail on the island and that anyone arrested has to be brought to the mainland. So are they in handcuffs or locked in a brig or something like that?
Well, I think they're typically, yes, in handcuffs and in the back of a squad car.
Oh, okay, right. You do have the squad car, right? Yeah.
Yeah, we do have police officers on the island. And actually, I was just chatting with one of our officers who commented that in the last decade, say, those incidents have declined precipitously, apparently. There used to be, the culture was more about coming over the island and a lot of drinking and a lot of partying and, you know, more DUIs and more accidents and more arrests. And he commented that the island culture has changed somewhat. It's more family friendly. And he said, you know, he did have one transport so far this summer, but those situations have decreased, which is, I think we can all agree, welcome news.
Walk aboard the motor vessel Bayfield. Please follow the instructions of the crew in the event of an emergency. Life vests are located on the car deck and the upper deck. Additional safety information is posted in the red frames throughout the vessel. Smoking is prohibited anywhere on board, including in your vehicle.
Not to concentrate on a negative, but what about unruly passengers mid-trip? Have you ever demand anybody walk the plank? You know, bus drivers can do that and train. They actually, we just had on Ken Bueller from the North Shore Scenic Railway, and he's a big proponent of the train from the Twin Cities to Duluth. And there was a question some critics had about crime, and he said that he's been on Amtrak trains where they've stopped in the middle of nowhere and kicked the person off. So I don't know if you can do that.
We can't do that, but I have to be honest, unruly passengers almost always involve alcohol. And we have had passengers that are so inebriated that they can barely walk. And that's not a safe person to have on a boat. So we literally made them sit on the dock and sober up before we'll let them on the boat. And we've called the local police and said, can you ride along with us? Because when I'm up in the pilot house, I can't be monitoring for handling, you know, drunk or unruly passengers down on deck. So, and occasionally, it's very uncommon, but we can get the Bayfield police on the phone and have them waiting for us on the other side if there are people who are, you know, not cooperating.
That'll sober them up real quick when they see that, you know, the flashing lights waiting, yes.
And we've had it happen, and it does make an impact. It makes an impression on people. So we do have some revelers and people that have obviously come over to the island to have a good time. Almost always. They're pretty reasonable. But sometimes we have to get tough, and it's not my favorite part of the job at all, but we have right. Our resources to take care of that.
We are speaking with Will Shub. He's a captain of the Madeline Island Ferry. What you just said there, it's not your favorite part of the job, but the favorite part of the job. Is it a job or a constant vacation?
Well, it's a good question. Sometimes it absolutely feels like a vacation. I love it. There's all kinds of things I could do, but I love my summers. I love being outside. I love getting some sun. I love being on the water. But, you know, another part of it is that I love being of service to the island. Without the ferry, there would be no Madeline Island. There'd be no La Pointe. Life as it is on the island could not function. It's kind of hard to imagine that everything that's on the island, we bring over. We bring over lumber. We bring over cement. We bring over all the groceries. We bring over absolutely everything that's here. You know, the power goes down, we're on the run bringing the power trucks over to get the lines back up. So without the ferry, there'd be no Madeline Island. And so it makes me feel good that I'm something other than just a consumer over here. I'm part of the community providing an essential service. And I don't know, that makes me feel good too, that I'm giving back to the island, not just, you know, absorbing the beauty. Which is great too.
Any particular crossings that come to mind as your best trips?
Well, in general, I think that I don't like working the night shifts very much. But I have to be honest, when I'm coming back from Bayfield and I see the full moon rising over Madeline Island and it's nice and calm, it's just like it's magical. You know, it's like I can't believe I'm getting paid to do something that just seems it's just so beautiful and dreamlike and romantic almost. You know, it's just moments like that are great. Or seeing the northern lights, you know, across Lake Superior. It's just like maybe a once in a lifetime opportunity. Stuff like that. I've seen conversely the sunrise back in the day when we had very early morning runs. It's just a beautiful way to experience Mother Nature, you know, being on the water. I still remember a trip we made in 87. It was an electrical storm like I had never experienced, and it was just dumping rain, and the lightning was just like a strobe light. And in the moment, it wasn't fun at all, but I remember that trip, you know, 30-something years later, like, what the heck were we doing out there? But we were getting people back and forth, and it was an exciting ride. So, yeah, there's almost every day. Well, I shouldn't say every day, but, you know, things happen. And it's I will say this, no two crossings are ever the same. It's just the lake changes, the weather changes, the wind and the sunlight, and it's just like some days I get off at the end of the day, I feel like I've had a whole week, you know. it's hard to, you know, believe it all happened in one day. So amazingly, right. I would, you know, we have a 2.5 mile run. An obvious question is, do you ever get bored? And my answer is honestly no. Somehow it always interesting. It's always fun, and it doesn't get repetitive to me.
You took the final question out of my mouth. We've been speaking with Captain Will Shub of the Madeline Island Ferry. Thank you for joining us, Captain Will.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, and enjoy your trip.
Coming up, the regional news and review. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
So you've given us updates on the new Essentia building going up in Duluth. The scheduled completion is this summer, and they're even beginning to hold tours. The other hospital in town is expanding in another way and better connecting to Wisconsin.
Yes, St. Luke's Hospital plans to affiliate with Aspirus Health, which is a Wisconsin-based healthcare giant. Aspirus Health, which operates 17 hospitals, 75 clinics, and other health facilities in Wisconsin and in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, announced Wednesday morning it signed a letter of intent to affiliate with St. Luke's, which operates a hospital in Duluth, another in Two Harbors, as well as other healthcare facilities in the Northland. The two healthcare systems hope to complete the deal by 2024. They signed the letter of intent a few weeks ago. The combined organization will operate 19 hospitals and 130 outpatient facilities and employ 14,000 staff members. Hospital leaders said the combined organization will have better access to capital, unified technology systems, larger scales, and efficiencies. St. Luke's currently employs about 3,000 people. Aspirus employs about 10,000 people. St. Luke's recently started construction on a $58 million three-story addition to Building A at its Duluth campus, part of the $72 million second phase of its Health Forward initiative. The expansion will consolidate cardiac care into one building. It is expected to be complete by the end of 2024. As part of the second phase, St. Luke's will also transition all of its hospital rooms into private rooms with updated technology and will demolish and rebuild the Northland parking ramp on East 1st Street. Duluth's other healthcare system, Essentia Health, has also eyed an expansion of its reach into Wisconsin. It announced in October it was exploring a possible merger with the Marshfield, Wisconsin Clinic Health System. The two systems would form a combined network of 3,500 providers and more than 150 sites, including 25 hospitals.
All right. Well, in addition to hospitals, another connection between our part of Minnesota and Wisconsin is the Can of Worms interchange, I-35 and 535, that will take you to and from those hospitals. What's the latest on the rebuild?
Yes, the Twin Ports interchange project is on track to open Interstate 35 to traffic in both directions on permanent pavement in November. At a public meeting June 26, project managers said other milestones on the horizon include substantial completion of the project in fall 2024 and final completion in fall 2025. While progress on the $435 million project continues, construction on the Highway 53 bridge hit a snag when indigenous remains were discovered on site in February. The Minnesota Department of Transportation is still evaluating the impact of that discovery. In the meantime, the construction team is continuing to work on unaffected parts of the bridge. Another complication in construction has been dealing with contaminants in the soil, such as asbestos and lead, left behind from the demolition of neighborhoods to build the original Highway 53 bridge in the 1970s. Asbestos has to be handled by a trained contractor. They load that soil into a truck and cover it in plastic so the particles don't blow away in transit. The construction team also discovered contaminated groundwater. So they pump all the groundwater through their own treatment system, which removes the sediment to which many contaminants are bound. Despite these challenges, though, dry weather since early May has benefited construction. When the project wraps up in 2025, local streets will be constructed after being subjected to heavier traffic from detours. Garfield Avenue, for example, has sustained five times the amount of traffic it had prior to when the Twin Ports Interchange project broke ground.
Well, I'm pretty sure the Can of Worms rebuild is all set with construction workers. I hope they are at this point. But the city of Duluth is looking at helping train workers for other local projects.
Yes, city officials joined an elite group of representatives in Washington, D.C. this week, where Duluth is one of just 16 communities across the nation selected to participate in a Good Jobs, Great Cities Academy, a two-day event put together by the National League of Cities in partnership with the U.S. Department of Labor. Victoria Woodwards, who's the president of this organization and mayor of Tacoma, Washington, said the gathering kicks off a year-long initiative. Participants will meet with Department of Labor staff who will offer technical assistance tailored to each community's labor needs. More than 250 cities sought to attend the academy, according to Acting Secretary of Labor Julie Sue. The 16 were selected because of their demonstrated innovation, their commitment to equity, and their real leadership in looking at ways to align their own resources to take advantage of these historic federal investments. Duluth Mayor Emily Larson led a five-member local team and said the Duluth delegation focused on improving the pipeline of talent for local manufacturers by drawing on a more inclusive and diverse pool of workers. The team is looking to create easier pathways for people to train up and land solid-paying jobs in the manufacturing industry. Larson said that over the next decade, Duluth manufacturers anticipate they will need to hire about 7,000 more people due to projected growth and worker attrition as current employees reach retirement.
Okay. In your recap a minute ago of the I-35 rebuild, you mentioned the dry weather we've been having. We've had some really lovely days in much of the region, but not enough moisture, particularly on the Wisconsin side. WPR's Danielle Kading has this report.
The latest data from the U.S. Drought Monitor shows nearly 93% of the state is under drought conditions, affecting more than 5 million residents. As of June, the state had seen a shortfall of anywhere from 2 to 6 inches of rain, prompting more irrigation. Rob Washbush is a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He says stream flows have been declining since May.
We're low right now. We're not extremely low, but we could sure use some rain.
In central Wisconsin, flows on a section of the Little Plover River that's been known to dry up in stretches are currently running below the minimum healthy level set by the state. A water resources expert says that's due largely to irrigation. A 2016 study found the groundwater-fed stream is vulnerable to impacts from nearby pumping.
And that was WPR Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading. We've been joined by Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with more of the music of Michael Baker as drummer and music director for the late Whitney Houston. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
If tomorrow is Judgment Day, and I'm standing on the front line, you look so pretty. And the Lord asks me what I did with my life, I will say, I spent it with you. Is alright. As the years they pass us by, we stay young in each other's eyes.
Something to say.